I felt embarrassed that I was going so slowly yesterday. Well, maybe that was a good thing. And so I've switched to slides. So if I go too fast, do please slow me down and stop me from sort of running away without having anyone knowing what I'm talking about. So just in the last lecture then, I got to the point where we could write down some amplitudes. And we had the bosonic ambi-twister string action, which is just p dot d bar x. And with a Lagrange multiplier to make p squared vanish. And and we got a bunch of amplitudes where we had a formula here for the amplitudes with IL and IR being essentially just a product of epsilon I dot p sigma I squared. And that, so I guess what we had, in some sense, IL equals IR equals that without the square, I suppose, in this formula. And so the point here is that these are actually one forms on the world sheet. Well, so epsilon dot p is I called it k, just omega 1, 0 on the world sheet. And what we'd like to do is to replace this epsilon dot p with something which is going to give the correct answers. And perhaps in the first instance, we were led to what gives the correct answers by closely examining the formulae of, the CHY formulae, the Freddie Ellison Song's formulae. So the so what we're going to do then is instead of having this epsilon dot p squared as the, if you remember this quantity here was really coming out of the variation in the simplex potential. So we had this sort of formula for a momentum eigenstate giving rise to a variation in simplex potential, which looked like this. And the strategy is going to be to add additional fields on the world sheet, which I haven't yet named, and they will have action SL and SR. And we're going to replace this then with VL, VR. VL basically coming from the SL matter system and VR coming from the SR matter system. Remarkable thing is that these two matter systems are quite separate and decoupled, but will nevertheless combine to give you amplitudes for gravity and Yang-Mills, and maybe it's worth saying a bit more about that later. So, so that's the strategy of what I'm going to do for most of this lecture, and this looks maybe a little bit arbitrary, but what we will see is that in good, so you might ask the question as to why is it that these amplitudes aren't actually present, the ones with epsilon dot p squared. What we'll see is, in fact, that with the new matter systems, you will get new invariances. So you have new BRST operator, and that will rule out this particular choice, but will give you an improved choice, which will actually give you the correct gravity amplitudes. And we can also impose some discrete symmetries to make sure that this really is the only thing that the that the correct formulae are the only things that we can get. So just to remind you what we're aiming for, in Freddie's lectures, I'm hoping you will have seen a formula that looks a bit like this for amplitudes, where we have this structure of the delta functions enforcing the scattering equations, and the two quantities, the IL and the IR, corresponding to the choices of IL and IR will correspond to different formulae that the different theories that we want to get. So one of the things I should have said here is that IL will then just be the correlator of the VL1 up to VLN, and the IR will end up being the VR1 up to VRN. So these two matter theories on the world sheet won't couple to each other. When we take the path integral or the correlator of all of these vertex operators, we'll be able to do these two theories just independently and form these correlators independently. So the most non-trivial part of the CHY formulae comes when from these so-called Pfaffians, or these generalized Pfaffians. And these Pfaffians were built out of polarization data. So for spin one, you have a vector, epsilon mu, which would... So there you're imagining that you're looking at maybe a Maxwell field or a Young-Mills field, which is epsilon mu times e to the 2 pi I k dot x. And there's an on-shell condition that k dot epsilon should vanish, and there's a gauge freedom where epsilon can be varied by a multiple of k. And for spin two, we just have two of these, although we'll actually allow epsilon l and epsilon r to be different. So for a symmetric metric, epsilon l and epsilon r would be the same, or it would be symmetric. But when you deal with supergravity theories, you have a B field, which is like a skew path of the metric. And so, in fact, we make epsilon L and epsilon R different. And the main idea in the CHY Pfaffians is to construct this 2n by 2n matrix where the blocks are given by ki dot kj for the momenta divided by the difference between the insertion point sigma I and sigma j, and similarly with b being the epsilons and c being the some mixed terms, the k dot epsilons. And a and b are skew symmetric, c isn't skew symmetric, and it has diagonal terms which are just given by epsilon dot p at sigma I. So In the first series of formulae that CHY had, you could do Young-Mills and gravity. So for Young-Mills, we had a Pfaffian on the left, and this what's known as a Park-Taylor factor on the right, where you have products of one over the differences between. So we have a cyclic ordering, and we have product over differences between consecutive sigmas. But for gravity, we just have a Pfaffian on the left and a Pfaffian on the right. So that's a brief summary of the original CHY formulae. There's also a formula, actually, where we have a Park-Taylor factor on both the left and the right, and that was this bi-adjoint scalar theory. And so what I want to do now is to explain how these formulae come out of world sheet matter. So, okay, but before I do that, I just want to say that CHY will recognize this blob diagram from their paper. So in the 2013, they just had these three sets of formulae, the gravity, Young-Mills, and bi-adjoint scalar theory. But then in 2014, they did a whole load of new things. I'm not sure they're all here on this diagram, but by squeezing and compactifying and generalizing and so on, they massaged their formulae from gravity to Einstein-Maxwell to Einstein-Young-Mills, Bornenfeld. Anyway, these are so lots and lots of theories, 5 to the 4th, and Young-Mills scalar and so on and so on. So what I want to do is to explain sort of how all of these theories can be attained from different choices of world sheet matter. But anyway, the main highly non-trivial thing is the Pfaffian, and this comes out of a world sheet supersymmetry. So just thought of on its own, we introduce a spinner on the world sheet. So that's a square root of the canonical bundle psi. So this is a vector, so that the mu index is a space-time vector index going from 1 to d. And we have this action for it where we just have the simple psi d bar psi. That's the standard Dirac equation on the world sheet. But we also have an extra gauged current. So chi, just as we had E here as a Lagrange multiplier that enforces a constraint P squared equals zero, and a gauge field that generates, in this case, it was the motion up and down the null geodesics. Here, we've got another Hamiltonian P dot psi, which will generate a gauge symmetry as well. So the constraint, obviously, is just P dot psi equals zero. And the gauge symmetry is generated by this fermionic vector field here. So, so just in the variation of P x psi, it's going to be so P doesn't vary, but x picks up psi and psi picks up P. And of course, delta chi. So we'd have some epsilon times that, and delta chi would be d bar epsilon. And so this is a gauge symmetry of that action. And now, supersymmetry is usually square to give you a translation. And here, what we find is that this this supersymmetry here squares to give us this vector field along the null geodesic. So P dot d by dx is just the flat space version of the Hamiltonian flow of P squared. And we can actually think of this then as defining a supersymmetric version of ambi-twister space. So we could say that what we're doing here is we're taking the cotangent bundle of space-time, but we're adding on a parity reversed. Sometimes you so a fermionic bundle that's with the well, I've got the index up there, so that pi is meant to mean that we're dealing with the fermion. We've declared the tangent vectors to be odd and this to be even. So there's psi is thought of as being in there, p is in the cotangent. And then this is restricted now not just to p squared equals zero, but also p dot psi. And then we take the quotient by the Hamiltonian flow of p squared, but also this vector field d, which you could think of as being that Hamiltonian vector field of psi dot p. If you have a now supersymmetric contact structure, p dot dx plus psi d psi. So all of these things just have vector indices. And so we can think of this matter system as really being associated with a sort of supersymmetrization of ambi-twister space in this way, complete with a theta s. And we could then run through an argument for the Penrose transform, as I did before, where if you you can ask the question as to what happens if you so this was the variation in the symplectic potential corresponding to a variation in the metric, which looked like just a momentum eigenstate. And what you can do here is you could say, well, what's delta theta if you vary the metric or the geometry of this spacetime here? And what we'll just I'm jumping the gun a bit here because I would need to do this with two of these psi's. So maybe I should do that. Well, so I guess so what I've done here is I've just written down one matter system. This can form an SL, and so for So maybe the best way to say this then is if we have SL equal to S psi 1 or psi L and SR equals S psi R, then you'd of course then have plus psi L d psi L plus psi R dot d psi R. And then what you'll discover is that the variation of this symplectic potential under varying the geometry would actually be the square of this thing. So we'd end up with epsilon L dot P plus epsilon L dot psi L K dot psi times epsilon R dot P plus epsilon R psi R K dot psi R. And this would then be our integrated vertex operator. Okay, so so to quantize this system, then we do the standard gauge fixing, and we because this chi is now fermionic, psi was fermionic, chi has to be fermionic as well, and that means that the ghosts have the opposite parity, beta and gamma, and And now the gamma has to be a square root of the tangent bundle on the world sheet. And so in the case of the symmetries of the bosonic string, we had, E was roughly speaking d bar alpha with alpha section of the tangent bundle. But when we went to look at the ghosts for that was a section of the tangent bundle with the gauge fixing that E was equal to zero, that would have to be holomorphic. Here, with the gauge fixing that chi is equal to zero, we discover that the residual gauge, which is going to be measured by the gamma, has to be holomorphic. And so gamma's has two dimensional space of holomorphic sections, so two zero modes. And that means that you need you need to fix those, and the way you fix them is essentially just by putting a delta function at some point on the Riemann surface. So you're just setting gamma equal to zero at some point. You need two fixed vertex operators to kill the two possible degrees of freedom of gamma. And so we need two operators that look like this, that go alongside the standard, as many as you like, the integrated vertex operators that look like that. And this is all to do with fixing the residual gauge that's left over once you do the original gauge fixing. So this is a standard thing in conventional string theory. And in fact, this looks very much like the standard. You can find all this sort of machinery in Doe and Fong, although the supersymmetry acts slightly differently. Oops. Yeah. No, this is actually the supersymmetry is there in the target, but you don't see it in the RNS formalism. So I'll say a little bit more about that later. But this is again parallel to standard string theory. The supersymmetry in the target is something you have to really work hard to extract. So I'm not saying it's not there. I'm saying that you don't put it in explicitly.
I'm just trying to understand the logic, because you did mention having supersymmetric matter. I mean, you added extra matter, and
this is matter on the world sheet. And this couples into the space-time geometry. So I haven't actually written down the curve space version of that. To write down the curve space version, you need to extend the d-bar actually on psi to have a connection coefficient. And there are actually some other terms as well, which there are some.
So I should think of this as a standard sigma model, but into a supersymmetric target.
Sorry. Okay. So I'm not really saying it in the best possible way. This can be thought of as a map from a supersymmetric world sheet into a bosonic target. And so the what I've done here is I've suppressed the world sheet supersymmetry formalism. And so what you can imagine is that we have a fermionic coordinate on the world sheet as well. So instead of just having sigma, you've got sigma and a little theta. Sorry, we've already got a theta. Need some other Greek letter. Some we've already got psi. Okay. You've got some fermionic parameter on the world sheet, and then you have x is a function of sigma and tau, and then that expands to being x of sigma plus tau times psi of sigma. And tau is a fermion on the world sheet, so the psi, so tau is a square root of t, so tau psi is a square root of k. And in fact, we have two of these supersymmetries. We've got the tau L and the tau R. So that's the geometry of what we're dealing with, is a map from a supersymmetric world sheet into the bosonic target.
You started with just not geodesic, which is a geometrical object.
Right.
So now psi has to do with some spin or something.
So there
has to be a natural explanation, independently of all these strings.
That's actually a separate point to a certain extent. So why would you even think of attaching this psi to a null geodesic? Yeah. So it's a spin vector, and why might you want your spin vector to be fermionic? Well, when you quantize it, then what you'll discover is that psi turns into it satisfies. In the string, it does something complicated. You have this will have an OPE with itself, sigma psi nu sigma prime is sort of delta or g mu nu sigma minus sigma prime. But if you just think of case where we were considering a single word line, then we would just have that psi. If you think of a Hamiltonian version, these satisfy the Clifford algebra, and then on a word line instead of a string. So that's on the string. Anyway, so on the word line, these psi's then turn into the gamma matrices under quantization, standard gamma matrices or Clifford algebra, and And then the P dot psi is then sort of turning into the Dirac equation. So it's sort of gamma dot D, you know, gamma mu, D mu, and that gives rise to the Dirac equation. So anyway, so for Yang-Mills, we have one of these, and for gravity, we're going to have two of these. So this is really just associated with having fields with spin. Okay, but we get this extra structure that we have two fixed vertex operators along with n minus two integrated vertex operators. And as I say, the n minus two integrated vertex operators could be understood in coming out of some Penrose transform for a supersymmetric ambient twister space. In the same way that we did the bosonic case. Well, no, because it's going to be integrated. Well, okay, so there's a all of these vertex operators delta theta are integrated over the Riemann sphere. They're 1-1 forms on the Riemann sphere, and one uses the term integrated versus unintegrated. Here, this is really with respect to a fermionic symmetry. So the integrated versus unintegrated is associated with the diffeomorphism symmetry. This here is really being associated to a fermionic diffeomorphism. And there's a descent process coming from standard string theory, which relates the U to the V. So you can see, in fact, that going from here to here, we just take the anticommutator with P dot psi with the fermionic constraint.
So you mean U is going to be evaluated at one point, but V is going to be integrated?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the best way of saying it. I mean, but in order for this to be integrated at one point, this has to come with C. OK, so there's a certain amount of machinery with string theory, which I didn't really want to get too much into. You can also... there's a worry, if you've got this as your SL, you might worry as to how you stop yourself mixing SL and SR fields in your vertex operators. In general, you take the view that anything you can write down is fair game, as long as it's Q invariant. And one way you can make sure that these come as currents as they are is to impose an analog of this GSO symmetry that you have for conventional string theory, which simply reverses the sign of the psis and the ghosts. So, so that means that you have to have U or V, and you have to have U or V in order for it to be BRST invariant. If you don't have U or V, then your vertex operator will not be BRST invariant. So it's a very strong condition, the supersymmetry. It forces you to have the right vertex operators. Okay, now I have this claim here now that the world sheet correlator gives rise to this Pfaffian, and so the Pfaffian was on the previous slide, wasn't it? Oops. I don't know if people are happy to accept that as a plausible statement. Then I'll move on. What you can see here is that the A, B, and C are all the possible contractions we have terms of the form epsilon dot psi, k dot psi, and the way in which you actually perform one of these you actually compute one of these correlators is really just to line up all the operators and take all possible contractions between them. And it's a sum over all possible such terms, but because they're fermionic, it comes with signs. And so so once you've contracted two operators, you get the dot product of the two vectors, either k dot k epsilon dot epsilon or k dot epsilon, and you also get the Green's function and for d bar, which just on fermions. And the only exception to that is we've got these epsilon dot p terms as well, and they feed in a natural way into the diagonal terms of C. So that just gives you at least a hand-waving idea as to how it is that this correlation function of the V's would give rise to a Pfaffian of a matrix like this. This is a Pfaffian prime. What you've done is you've actually removed two rows and columns from this matrix, and that simply corresponds to the fact that we have these two of these fixed vertex operators here. There are no k dot size here. There's only epsilon dot size in those two. So it's the same argument, but just applied to the reduced matrix. And the two delta gammas come together to give you the extra fact that you need in the definition. I didn't actually define what this was. So anyway, so I just wanted to give you a plausibility argument.
So apart from the world shape point of view, that's a special feature of E1.
So that's right, yes. So for when we look at the elliptic curve, there will be a different number of these fixed vertex.
And you expect a different Pfaffian prime, a different expression.
That's right. So in fact, you see, because this will be in a spin bundle, for most of the spin bundles, that there will be no sections, and there will be none of these unintegrated vertex operators. Okay, I mean, it depends whether the spin structure is odd or even. What I should probably have done here was have a slide that actually just summarised what happened, because this is what you have for gravity. If your SL if you have, so this gives rise to type 2 gravity, if you have both SL being one of these spinners and S psi being one of these world sheet symmetries. So the two world sheet symmetries lead to type 2 gravity. This is critical in 10 dimensions. And the calculation is identical to the standard stream calculation, essentially, this criticality. And it therefore leads to really the best of these models. And I'll say a bit more about it later. So in many ways, this is the best of the models. But we had these other models. We had models for Yang Mills and bijoint scalars and whatnot. And the first approach to this was to introduce free fermions. I mean, this of course looks very similar to what we've had up there. But now the index on the fermions is no longer a space-time vector index. It's just going to be some arbitrary index A going from 1 to m. Now, when we were first doing this, we were thinking of these as generating a current algebra. One way that you can think of this as doing so is just taking this combination of the world sheet fermions, and then they satisfy this current algebra relation. So that they embody the structure constants of some Lie group, and but it's a standard fact that because you've got two of the rows, that the rows have the OPE I've got a third one here. So the rows have an OPE just delta AB over sigma. But J is made out of two of them, so you can get 1 over sigma squared. And and the coefficient there is usually called the level. And anyway, so these rows were spinners on the world sheet. J is a one form, and so we can use these as ingredients in the vertex operators. And it's a standard fact that T will be an element of the Lie algebra. When we were thinking about the an infinitesimal Yang-Mills field, so this A is what you'd have for a Maxwell field, for a Maxwell potential. And here you would throw in the Lie algebra element as well. So the TA can be thought of as part of the polarization data for a Yang-Mills field. And this then gives you a vertex operator for that Yang-Mills field. And anyways, so it's a standard fact you get these part Taylor factors where you get a sum. So what I've written here is slightly illusory. You get a sum over all permutations of expressions of this form, where this trace here is basically this delta AB up there. So when you write down an amplitude for a gauge theory, you need to worry about the invariance you have of the algebra elements that form the polarization data for the Yang-Mills fields. And one way of doing that is to have a trace of the product of these things, of course, of the algebra elements. But this actually has problems in the sense that there are lots of other ways that these rows can contract, and you actually get multi-trace terms. These are incorrect for tree-level Yang-Mills. You don't get them. We just sort of, in the original models, we just threw them away. We sort of said, well, we don't like them, but we can sort of ignore them because you know how to separate them out. But, you know, it's wrong. It's not the right theory. And so Dave and Eduardo, so this was in the context of twister strings originally, came up with a system which avoided the multi-trace terms. And the way in which you actually get a trace in the end when you think about this correlator is because you have this extra delta, extra trace there. You can construct current algebras that actually have level zero. But if you take a current algebra that has level zero, then there is no trace. You take the correlator of a bunch of currents like that, and you actually get zero because there's no way you can end up with a trace at the end of the process. There's another nice way of thinking about. The trace was thinking about the algebra elements as really in a representation. So you're thinking of the trace as being just taking T alpha beta, T beta gamma, and so on, and then lining it up at the end. The trace of a bunch of those was looking like that. There's another way of forming a basis of the sorts of invariants that you need to describe tree amplitudes. And this was discussed by a group of people, Dixon, Del, Duca, and it says DQDEM. I can't remember who the M is now. Mantoni, maybe. Anyway, so what you do is you form invariants by, you can think of them as in general, as arising from some trivalent diagram where you have structure coefficients at the three-point vertices, and then you have contractions along the edges. And these different diagrams, the trivalent diagrams, are not all independent. But you can form a basis, if you fix one and n, you can form a basis out of cones. So you might have 2, 3 up to n minus 1, but you might have permutations of those n minus 2 terms. And so these form a basis of the allowed color structures at tree level for or invariants of the different T's. So you imagine just putting a T into each of those onto each end of the cone. So the idea of this cone system then is that we're going to exploit this fact that if you have a spin three halves current, if you have one of these sort of world sheet supersymmetries, the we're going to want to have two fixed vertex operators, and they're going to give us the 1 and n in the comb, and then the rest of them will be, so to speak, integrated vertex operators. And so David Eduardo came up with such a thing, and in order to have a current algebra at level 0, what you do is you start off with two fermions and you generate something in the way that we thought before. I'm describing these as complex fermions, but you could think of them as real, you know, double them up and think of them as real. But then you have some bosons. So these are all spinners on the world sheet, but you have fermions and as many bosons as well. And the central charges will cancel then, and you'll get something at level 0 when you form the corresponding currents. And this current that we're gauging is actually sort of familiar from the standard BRST structure of a when you gauge when you do BRST gauge fixing in a gauge theory, and so this is a consistent current, and so it can be gauged. And so we do the usual trick of gauge fixing with gamma equals 0, and we get ghost beta gamma, which are just like the original ones in the sense that gamma is a section of the square root of the tangent bundle. And so we will need two fixed operators in delta gamma with the rest integrated. A slight awkwardness here is that we have twice as many vertex operators as we really wanted. We only really wanted one for every t, and we have two. We have a rho and a rho tilde, and we have this v and this v tilde. And these are both... so this is the level zero current algebra, the v tilde, but this one here is sort of degenerate. Rho has no contractions with itself. Anyway, so the upshot of this, though, is that if you take two fixed, so to be non-trivial, we can only have one untilded vertex operator, and to be non-trivial, if I have more than one, it'll vanish, and then we get this comb structure for the color factor and a Park-Taylor denominator. So this is sort of a key new idea in this. But if that's the only idea that we have, we still end up with the same models that we had in 2013. So with SL and SR being the world sheet supersymmetries, we get type 2 gravity. We have a heterotic model with one of these comb systems and a world sheet supersymmetry, and that gives rise to Yang-Mills amplitudes. But now at least we have the benefit that there are no multi-trace terms. And if we just have two of these comb systems, we get a Baryonic scalar again with no multi-trace terms. So that's nice. I mean, and we can worry about the doubling of vertex operators later.
Extra stuff that you get because of the comb system.
Well, so really, the it's not so much extra stuff. It's the fact that to get honest gravity, we need to do. We needed to have gravitational vertex operators that had the epsilon dot p corrected with the psi term, which may be still up somewhere up. So we need both of them corrected in that way. But if you just have the SCS. There'll be a corresponding gravity vertex operator that you're allowed to insert, which is just epsilon dot p. And that epsilon dot p will give you the wrong amplitudes. Now, I think that amplitude is probably more easily understood than the bosonic one, in the sense that I think it's, at least in four dimensions, it probably has an interpretation to do with conformal gravity. But that's not been proved. It's not completely clear. Okay, so but can we do better than this? Well, as it stands, the comb system hasn't really given us much. It's just allowed us to avoid multi-trace terms. But when you start sort of staring at the CHY formally, and Ellis visited and you know, spent a long time sort of just seeing how we could sort of combine them, we realized that in fact we could combine these matter systems in various ways. So in the first case, yeah, what happens if you have two world sheet supersymmetries for SL? You know, so we had one world sheet supersymmetry for SL and one for SR, but we could have actually had two for SL. And you actually, it's very restrictive because you have to have this Q invariance. You've now got a P dot psi 1 and a P dot psi 2 generating symmetries, which are going to kill a lot of the vertex operators, but you still get one now surviving. So before you got one for each choice of vector epsilon, but now we just get this one here with the K being the momentum. And so it's giving you something non-trivial. And similarly, we can think of this as being something that's just on one side in the sense that we are only allowed those vertex operators. You know, even if we had for SR another world sheet supersymmetry, we can have a sign reversal symmetry on just these fields in S psi 1 and S psi 2, and that would be all we are allowed for that those vertex operators. So we can combine real fermions with the supersymmetry story as well. And so this is something which we really should have thought of doing a couple of years ago. I mean, this actually it's not 2 years ago, a year ago. And then we get a fixed vertex operator times new fixed vertex operators that involve the free fermion, and these come in fixed and integrated types. And finally, we can play a game with the new comb system and the supersymmetry, in the sense that we, instead of gauging these two currents separately, we can gauge them together. And if we gauge them together, what we discover is the vertex operators get terms which somehow, so the fixed ones look as they did before, but the integrated ones get terms which are somehow allowing the gravity to interact with the gluons. And what we discover is that, before, you see, we said we could only have one U, and then because you need to have as many rows as row tildes, you have to somehow generate new rows in order to get an amplitude, but we can only have these two fixed vertex operators. But now with this extra term here, we can get extra rows, and that allows us to have more U's in the more untilded vertex operators in the system. Okay, so having this combined system with the comb system and the supersymmetry on one side, this is maybe the most interesting example. I'm already at 10:30. Okay, so the this gives you what we call what I've been calling T star Yang Mills. So the graviton vertex operators have the same formula as they had before, and so they can be combined with the vertex operators I gave you on the previous at the bottom of the previous slide, and you get combinations of these comb invariants with Park Taylor factors, and you get the Pfaffian, the generalized Pfaffian that CHY discovered for Einstein Yang Mills on the nose times an ordinary Pfaffian. So really what's happening here is that at tree level for pure Yang Mills, you're only allowed single color structures, but for gravity, you're allowed lots and lots of these color structures because the gravitons can if that's a graviton interaction that can interact between these various different Yang-Mills amplitudes. And the fact that we've got twice as many gluons as we wanted means that, in fact, we've got two gauge fields in the system, and the actual action that we have is, I call it T star Yang-Mills, because we have a standard, A is a Lagrange multiplier for the standard Yang-Mills equations on the connection A tilde, but then when you take the field equation for capital A, it's a linear field on that nonlinear background. And now we can actually get sort of proper Einstein Yang-Mills amplitudes, but we have to replace this comb system with some other system which is highly anomalous. So the nice thing about the comb system is it actually doesn't have any anomalies, but we have to replace it with something which is not going to have any extension to loop amplitudes. It's still 10 for this system. Yeah.
It's always 10, you never get 4.
Well, I'll say a little bit about that. So, I mean, just to, I should finish off very quickly, but just to make contact with the CHY work, you can now see that with these combined matter systems, we can get all the formulae that CHY came up with. So I guess, well, I mean, this table kind of hopefully speaks for itself. You know, you've got Einstein, Born-Imfeld, Dirac Born-Imfeld, Einstein Maxwell, Einstein Yang-Mills, and so on and so on. And okay. And I guess one can, there's this table here. Ah, it's now too big. It lists the critical dimensions of all the theories. So you can see that, Einstein is critical in 10 dimensions, but you can fiddle around with the critical dimension by throwing in numbers of Maxwell fields. And, you know, the Galilean theory, for better or worse, is critical in 2 dimensions. And the critical dimensions are up here, the central charge. So you have to make the central charge vanish for the critical dimension. Sorry, so this is d equals 10 for the, sorry, this here, T star Yang-Mills is referred to as little Einstein Yang-Mills and so on. So on its own, it's 12 dimensions for some reason.
For gravity, you need a constant. So you can get d equals 4 if you add enough.
That's right, yes. Yeah, so you can. M was the Maxwell. It's a number of different Maxwell fields. So M is if you make M equal to 36, is that right? If you have 36 Maxwell fields, you can work in 4 dimensions. Yeah.
The natural gauge group. 36 Maxwell.
I haven't thought about it. Well, these are all abelian. I mean, it's U1 to the 36.
Oh, so they can't be non-abelian. Okay.
These ones can, but they're all in 10. These are this funny T star Yang-Mills, and the other way we have of getting Yang-Mills is anomalous, so we can't even talk about this. You have to go to fractional connection for the nonlinear signal model, for better or worse. Okay, I better finish there. The I could just flash up a slide on quantum gravity loop integrand and then move on just to say that you could do all this in one loop if you like. And here's a 4-particle formula for the amplitude, which has lots of theta functions and so on and so on, which Adamo Casali and Skinner came up with. Just to finish off then, the chiral alpha prime equals 0 strings in ambi-twister space using Lebrun's correspondence, and they give theories underlying the CHY formulae, both old and new, and they really incorporate nicely this color kinematics idea that Zvi Byrne and friends, or BCJ, have been talking about for some years now, whereby in some sense gravity is the square of Yang-Mills. You replace the part Taylor factors by these Pfaffians, this is something which is, I mean, this is really true. This is now a statement about full general relativity, because these amplitudes work to all orders. It's maybe a perturbative statement, but it's a statement about full GR. still, we're still struggling to get some insight into the geometry of BCJ. I mean, this is this remark here refers to some slides I missed out. The quantization ties scattering of null geodesics into that for the gravitational waves and so on. The critical models extend to loops, although there is something else that needs to be checked, which is the modularity. And so one could hope that the new representations will give new insights into loop integrands, if we're lucky. But really, I mean, yeah, it's still a great curiosity. I mean, what on earth is this Riemann surface doing in classical Yang-Mills, classical GR? Who asked us to, you know, in string theory, somehow that was a different theory. You had alpha prime taking you up with lots of extra stuff. But these are just equivalent to the standard Yang-Mills and gravity. So I think it's still a big mystery as to what that Riemann surface is doing. Why did we want that Riemann surface to help us formulate Yang-Mills and gravity in this very, very simple way? So can we say something about that in genuinely curved backgrounds? So okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Any questions?
I have a question. Let me focus on just one theory, which is Einstein. So, you know, gravity, and you say, okay, now you have a string description of pure Einstein, no extra massive field in dimension 10. And so usually one of the powers of string theory is because of modular invariants, when let's say you go to loop amplitude, you restrict the integration of momenta to this domain, and then you make makes this restriction. So you can have unitarity without integrating over full momenta. You integrate only on this power of moduli, so, and that makes string theory usually finite, at least UV is finite. So are you telling us that gravity in 10 dimension is finite or normalizable?
No, okay, I mean, let me...
So what happens with that?
I mean, let me just go back here then, you see. So in conventional string theory, the moduli space that you have to integrate over is compact.
Yes.
I mean, it does have boundaries, and so it's actually not compact in, you know, I mean, it can be compactified. You have the de Lieman for compactification. It has boundaries corresponding to generations of Riemann surfaces, but those are actually well understood to be the infrared limit, not the ultraviolet. And so the ultraviolet region is naturally compactified and curved in. In these models, you can see the loop momenta. So a genus G, P is a one form on the world sheet, and one forms have G moduli on a genus G Riemann surface, and so you have D times G zero modes for the momentum. And these can be interpreted as the loop momenta for G loop amplitude. And so these need to be integrated out, and they correspond precisely to the sorts of non-compact integrals that you get out of ordinary quantum field theory. And so at one loop, you see, just to write down an example of the formula, you have an integral over the modulus of the elliptic curve that you're getting, but you then have these 10 integrals over the zero modes for the P, which I've denoted here by P. You have scattering equations which fix tau. So this is, if we ignore this integral, this is actually still a bunch of residues. This is still a discrete set of points. But
sorry, usually in the string, and it's not clear from the formula, the integral of the moduli contains the integral of the
zero. Yeah, but it's compactified.
So
it's sort of puffed out to infinity in this model here. So the point is, this P is a separate variable that's decoupled from the X. In conventional string theory, P, you know, you can write down a P in conventional string theory, and the P is sort of just D of X. It's dx by d sigma.
You don't have an equation like that.
And we don't have an equation like that. So the moduli for X is already the same as the moduli for P. Whereas RP is running free, and it has these non-compact moduli. But, you know, I mean, we do believe there's formula. I mean, there's an act of faith there, which but we have some good arguments now. And I think it really is giving you the loop integrand, complete with all the divergences of 10-dimensional supergravity. I mean, you know, you can contract at this point. The modular invariance required that 10. So I was about to say that we could just cut down to 4,
What is the use of
is required to make this thing actually make sense.
This integral
would be would depend on how you draw your fundamental domain in the tau domain. So here we're doing an integral over the fundamental domain of the elliptic curve.
Usually, the fact that you know it's critical is I mean you want criticality to compactify the integral in some sense here you have that, but you don't have the
So we lose the compactness of the modular space.
Any other questions?